This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on today's episode, I'm chatting with Alan Campbell. Campbell's career has been anything but linear. He's done everything from television to film to starring on Broadway in Sunset Boulevard opposite Glenn Close, for which he was nominated for a Tony Award. This month, North Carolina audiences can see him star in the Judson Theater production of Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution. But that Pinehurst stage is a far cry from his first big acting break on the Three's Company spinoff Three's a Crowd, starring the late John Ritter. And that's where our conversation begins. You worked with the late John Ritter, one of my favorite comedic actors, and then as a series regular on Jake and the Fat Man for many seasons. Obviously, those are really different shows, but what was that experience? What was that television experience like?
I got the John Ritter piece, Three's a Crowd, from New York. I was a young actor in New York, very young actor. And I had auditioned for it while I was doing a play in Washington, D.C. at Ford's Theater. I just kind of just swung for the fences. It was, you know, the TV was the dream, but I was kind of pursuing a theater career in New York. And they said they were going to fly me out there. They liked the tape. Then you didn't do it from home. You actually went to a studio and they put you on tape. And I went out and I thought, oh, I was just going to meet with some people. And sure enough, I met John and I met the producers. So they were interested in me, obviously. And while I was out there, I went to the network and John actually went with me. I mean, some of the stories that show you the character of the man. He went with me to the network and did the scene with me. He did the scene with all the, like, three people they were considering. But kind of in a weird way, and maybe he did this with everybody, made me think that I was his favorite. Did the scene, I got the job, and I'll never forget, right after we had done, maybe taped one episode, and it went well, the networks do something called the presentation. So they kind of present their new shows and they have a big party and it's journalists. It was at the Century Plaza Hotel in Century City in Los Angeles. And John said, I tell you what, meet me outside. I think it started at 8 o'clock or 7:30. He said, meet me outside on the sidewalk. And I went, what in the world? John Ritter, I mean, he's a huge star. So I did. I kind of put on like some nice clothes and met him on the sidewalk. And he said, okay, let's go in. And we walked in through this phalanx of media. And they were taking a picture of us together. And the reason that he did this, because I was from New York. I was nobody. I was just, you know, nobody was interested in me. But because I walked in with John Ritter, I was suddenly part of the show. He embraced me. The media got a look, and that was, and he did things like that all the time, but I realized what he did is he said, I'm claiming this guy, you know, he's my guy, he's on the show, he's terrific, and those are the types of things that he did, and he did that throughout the show. One time he stopped by my apartment, I had no furniture because I started work right away. He just stopped by on his way home. He said, hey, I want to see where you live, and he stopped by and had no furniture. Nothing. Just I had like one mattress on the floor of a one-bedroom apartment and like a couple of apple boxes or something that I was sitting on. And I said, I just haven't had any time. You know, I didn't have a lot of money. I hadn't really started putting much money in the bank. I was a starving New York actor. And we just kind of sat around on the floor and talked. And I remember I went into work the next week. And one of the producers came up to me, Mickey Ross, one of the writers of The Jeffersons and All in the Family, Nichols, Ross, and Wes, these writer-producers that were very famous with Norman Lear and then on their own, said, hey, John tells me you need furniture. He said, we have a whole warehouse of furniture stored from the Ropers and from the Jeffersons, all these different shows. go in the warehouse, point some things out, tell you what you need. We'll put some notes on it, and we'll have a truck delivered to you. And I had, and I, and all my, I furnished my apartment with like old sitcom furniture. And it was only because John stopped by my house and saw that I didn't have any furniture. And he said, that's silly. And they just delivered it. And I never gave it back. I kept it. And then I got rid of it later. I mean, they didn't want it back. They said, just take it. We're just taking up room.
So when you work with TV royalty, like John Ritter, these writers, and then later on you work on a television web series, how has the industry changed when it comes to television?
Well, for me, the sitcom in the old days when I did this, I say the old days, the mid-80s, it was on video. So it was almost like doing a play for a live audience. It was kind of a lot like the theater. You rehearsed in a room, you know, for most of the week, and then you shot it one day.
And, in front of a live audience.
In front of a live audience. It's twice. You do the same show twice, and then they'd cut it and use the best takes and stuff. And so you got immediate response. You felt the audience. They'd laugh. You'd wait for the laughs. I think now when I did a Jake and the Fat Man, which was a film show, that was laborious because you'd have these very long days. And in those, the days before they used digital cameras, they used these big Panavision cameras and they shot film.
More on location, not...
Oh,
not
yeah. Like, well, we did in a studio, but we also did a lot of location shooting because the show came from Hawaii for three seasons, which was fabulous. Even working on film, because they shoot digital now, you don't have the time to check the gate. You don't use all these technical things, change out the magazines of film. The lighting is different now on digital. There's a lot of things that they can do with computers to kind of enhance the film and everything. So it's actually, in some ways, it's better because there's not so much waiting around. They shoot faster. I think you can do more for less money. But it feels like kind of something's been lost a little bit to me. You know, there's a kind of a grittiness these days, which I think is good. But some of the real polish, I think, that film provided and shooting on film has been lost in this kind of digital age. Although, you know, I look at television and it's so much better now than it's ever been. You know, I think everything from the acting to the types of shots that they're able to do. I mean, both the technology and I guess the cost of being able to shoot on digital, the amount of content because of streaming is just unbelievable. Some of the modern TV series that I watch or on Netflix and that stream, I'm just amazed at how filmatic and how good it all looks.
But then it's interesting. You have something like that reboot, you know, that one night, All in the Family, Jeffersons, yeah, more recent thing where they went back kind of old school, and it's delightful to watch a little bit, kind of very nostalgic.
Yeah, yeah. And I loved working like we worked on Three's a Crowd, because you were just in a studio with just the actors, a director, and a script person. And so it was safe. You could try things and fail miserably, you know. And I remember John used to do things, John Ritter, and Dave Powers was the director, and he had done all of the Carol Burnett Show, many Emmys. And he was kind of a dour fellow. And John would try something, and he'd say, "Is that funny, Davey?" And Dave would just look at him and either nod his head yes or shake his head no. And John would just say, okay. But it was, you know, that kind of ability to try things was a lot like the rehearsal process in the theater. You felt very safe and insulated. These people you loved and you respected, and you could just be silly, you know.
And that leads me to my next question. So how did your television experience, because you were on, I mean, Jake and the Fat Man, I think I read for like five years. Uh-huh. How did that television experience prepare you? It was just a couple years after Jake and the Fat Man ended that you end up making your Broadway debut opposite Glenn Close in Sunset Boulevard.
A year later.
So how did your TV work prepare you mm-hmm. for that Broadway stage experience?
Well, I don't think anything prepares you for walking into a room with, you know, Glenn Close, Judy Kuhn, and George Hearn, and Trevor Nunn. So for me, I think I started as a live performer, as kind of a singer with cover bands. You know, I had a rock band in high school. So I'd always loved the live performance thing. And my dream was musical theater to combine. You know, I love to sing. I kind of worked on acting. I danced. And I always thought, well, the culmination of everything that I love to do, and I love working live theater, and the culmination of that, to me, would be in a Broadway musical. But when I was first in New York and trying to get a job on stage, on Broadway, I was unsuccessful. I did a soap, I did some off-Broadway musicals. And it's funny, another guy that was doing the same thing and ended up on TV in LA with me was Brian Stokes Mitchell. And he was on Trapper John, and I was doing, and we'd get together at some benefits occasionally in LA, and we'd sing. You know, it was kind of a fundraiser thing. And it would be like, oh my God, you really have a great voice, Brian. And he said, so do you. And I said, man, we need to do musicals. And he said, yeah, but you know, this is paying the bills. Well, later he went back to do, I think, Jelly's Last Jam, and then then he was off. So it was always something that you know, I wanted to do, I'd planned to do, but I'd never gotten the opportunity. But so finally, when I was in LA, I got a chance to audition. In fact, I studied voice because I wasn't singing much with this guy that I found through an acting class that I took. And he was aware, a teacher by the name of Bob Korff, in LA, voice teacher, and he knew that they were coming into town to audition because he was preparing some other young male actors to audition for Andrew Lloyd Webber. He said, you're like the perfect type for this. You should audition for this. So I called my agent and I said, what about this? And he said, oh yeah. And so I auditioned and kept auditioning over 5 or 6 months, and again, had nothing to lose. I said, oh my God, I says, I'll never in this world get this. But I think, you know, it was just, it's like so many other things. It's the kind of the right look and the right set of skills at the right time. And I remember laughing. I wasn't 43, but they said, this is kind of, the character is kind of a desperate 43 or 40-ish, late 30s-year-old man. And Jake and the Fat Man had been off the air now, and I was saying, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? And I thought about it, and I said, yeah, I can do a desperate late 30s guy, because basically that's what I was, you know, trying to think, what do I do? You know, do I stay in LA? You know, I kind of bought a nice house, and I had a nice car, and I wanted to kind of keep those things. But I missed the theater, so I was thinking about going back east. I had a little money in the bank. And this thing came up, and that's the thing about these careers. I'd like to think that you can plan. You can't. Everything has always been like twists and turns and ups and downs. And so when I talk to young actors, I go, well, you know, I didn't study acting. I got a business degree. I studied after I got out of university. And my trajectory has been incredibly untraditional. I mean, I worked in Vegas for a while in lounges, and, you know, I've done a sitcom, a soap, an hour TV series, Broadway musical, some off-Broadway straight plays. So I guess the good thing about that is that it's been interesting because I haven't in a way gotten pigeonholed.
You've done comedies, dramas, musicals, straight plays, and we're going to get into Witness for the Prosecution in a second. Is there any one of those, talking about stage work, that you're more comfortable with or that you prefer?
First of all, I like and prefer theater. I mean, I just love theater. Musicals are more fun. They're just fun. You know, they're instinctually fun. I love to sing. I was a singer before I was anything else. They are a tremendous amount of work. They are almost athletic. And the older I get, the harder, you know, the more work they are. But they're joyful. They're hard. Book musicals are really hard to get right, you know. And I love doing them. But I also like theater that's about something. And I find that that straight plays sometimes, because whether you do Mamet or you do Lucas and Os the Christians or something, that you can actually foment some kind of a societal or social teaching within the theater. I mean, you can change minds, you can challenge people intellectually in a way that, let's be honest, a jukebox musical is not going to do. So, you know, I mean, and I'm a guy that's done Mamma Mia, and it came at a great time in my life, and it was more fun than I think I've ever had on a stage. But I don't know that we were doing anything but just purely entertaining people, and I take nothing away. There's absolutely a place for that. Broadway is doing bigger business than ever. But I also love pulling an audience in with language. And I also love intimate theater. And it's hard to do intimate theater with big musicals. I mean, you play big houses, and I like being close to audiences and kind of feeling the feedback. Audiences don't realize this, but even in a straight play, even in a drama or something, you get a sense. There's a little gasp, there's a little breathing and everything if you're aware of it. And theater's an actor's medium more than television and film.
So let's talk about Agatha Christie. There's very few storytellers that have this aura that Agatha Christie does.
Well, so she's a true master of her genre. And everything she does is meticulous, from the language to the development of character to the clues that she presents to the audience. And for the actor, it's a roadmap, as all text, as all scripts are. And if you follow it truthfully and you take it very seriously, you can have fun, because she writes some funny things within the character. But, you know, the payoffs, I think, are enormous. Both if you're reading her work, or if you're an audience looking at her work, or if you're an actor performing her work, I think there's an enormous kind of joy and glee about playing it straight, playing it for keeps, and allowing it to unfold. Because somebody told me, I did a little bit of research online, as you can do these days, that some law schools actually use this piece as an example in England, particularly, to how to develop evidence and cross-examine witnesses. It's so meticulously done that both the prosecutor and Sir Wilfred, as they develop the story and develop the evidence as it's revealed to the audience, it's also done as it would be done in an English court. You know, it's not, there's no like these huge Perry Mason moments that we always talk about that are kind of
those TV slightly moments.
Slightly pat and a little kind of squishy and everything. That doesn't exist in Agatha Christie. They're British. So they're, you know, kind of have a stiff upper lip about the way they develop things. They're slightly imperturbable. But I think that allows the audience to do the work. The play never does the audience's work for them emotionally. They allow the audience to figure it out, you know, and that's why it's so satisfying.
Well, and the play was based on a story she wrote, and then
short story
premiered in 1953. So this isn't a new play. How, or maybe why, does an older piece like this play to contemporary audiences?
Well, because the themes are universal, and also the language. You know, if you do any research on what we refer to as British RP, which is the dialect that these people use, it is, if you listen to William or Charles right now, the royal family speak, and how they phrase, and you listen to Sir Wilfred in 1950, 60, 50, 40, you listen to, you know, a book by C.S. Lewis, or you listen to that, the language is really fairly consistent. You know, it is taught, at least in Britain, it's almost timeless. This very upper-class, proper British kind of way in which they phrase things. And it's been challenging for me to learn 68 pages because, you know, as an American, I kind of cut to the chase a lot of times. They turn phrases in a way that is very, very British. Although it's not difficult, it doesn't fall on the ear in a difficult way. It's very easy to decipher for American audiences to listen to. But it is a very kind of proper English. And there are characters that are not as educated, so that will give contrast. But I think really the way evidence is developed and the way English courts are run, I think it's probably very similar to what you might see today. You know, the way you have to behave, you know, the way you have to respect witnesses and respect the jury and respect His Lordship, who's the judge with his wig on. You know, you can't be too crazy. It's not like the U.S. Congress. There's not a lot of performative narcissism allowed in a British courtroom.
So are you playing with dialects as well?
Yeah, I've been playing with it and trying to learn it. I've used it before in pieces. Mm-hmm. So I just had to refresh my memory. And as we go through rehearsal, I mean, I'll catch myself going, nope, that's an American pronunciation of that. I have to change that.
Clean it up.
Yeah, but that's part of the process.
You performed, I mean, we've talked about TV. We haven't talked a lot about your film work, but you've done film and theater. Theater is your favorite medium?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know so. I just love working for live audiences. You always have a chance to do it again. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, I am not somebody to be particularly self-satisfied in performances. So in theater, it's like I can walk out and go, yeah, not so much. That was good. That was like, but I get to do it again. And I'll change that. So I tend to like the trajectory of being able to improve a performance over time and to be able to enrich it and give it different levels and even change things, colors of phrases and things to see, not drastically and not disrespectfully to either the piece or the other actors on the stage, but to do it within a certain confine of to finding the best version of the character that I'm playing that I can possibly present. You know, film, you do it 4, 5, 6 times. Sometimes you do it out of sequence and then you move on. Mm. And once it's done, it's done. And that's hard sometimes. You know, I think it's hard for everybody. I mean, I've heard other big movie stars that say, ugh, you know, I can't even watch.
I was going to say, do you
such
watch,
and such?
You know.
I don't. I'm not a big fan of that. You know, I've never gone to Lincoln Center archive and looked at plays or Broadway shows I've done. It's just like, it's the live aspect. It's, you're only as good as that next one, you know, and that's one of the reasons I think that some people find theater harder and film easier is because theater does have an athletic quality to it. I mean,
8 shows a week. I mean,
yeah.
It's a rigorous schedule.
And you know, you can't run a cry-on under the stage saying, I had, you know, a few too many glasses of red wine last night. That's why I'm, you know, only 80%. You know, people pay their money. They expect your best. And it's your responsibility to be consistent, you know. And I remember Patti LuPone said something one time that I've always remembered. She said, just remember, you may walk out of a theater thinking that was the worst show you ever did. To the average audience who would seen your best show and your worst show, they would probably grade that within 5 or 10%. So if you are doing your job, you know, you are in that 95th percentile 8 times a week. We bring our lives to it, but you can't, you know, give an unfocused performance because that's not the job.
Do you have a favorite role?
Gosh. I love Sunset. I think just because it was operatic. It was kind of Shakespearean. It was just this huge emotional trip for the audience. For me, the actor, I just put my head down and got through 2 hours and 20-something minutes. And like you said, it was true to the material, but I saw the way it affected audiences, you know, taking that emotional trip. And so that was very satisfying to deliver that. And it was also musically, it was difficult. So to be able to deliver it, like you said, in that 90-95% was hard, but it was also satisfying. But I just did a show, a musical that's being developed, hopefully for Broadway, called Rock and Roll Man, about the life of Alan Freed, the early rock and roll pioneer, about a character that was a visionary and the music's joyful and it combines original music. And I had the time of my life doing that. Those are musicals. I like David Mamet because I find him very challenging. Not everybody does. That two people can watch the play and walk out of it arguing about completely different things that they've seen or taken from the play. I find that fascinating, you know. And so it's hard. It's hard to pick a favorite. I guess I don't. They don't come readily to mind in terms of the plays that I've done. I mean, I love doing some things that I was able to do that my daughter could finally see, because so much that I did when she was little was not appropriate for her. I remember when I went back to Broadway to do Mamma Mia, she was old enough to come. And I remember she was backstage watching me take the final bow at the end of the show during a mega mix with all the noise and confetti cannons and craziness and lasers that they had on Broadway. And my dresser, the man that helped with costuming, was like, had her on the shoulders because she had to have somebody with her backstage in this craziness. And I remember one of the ensemble members of the show came up to me, a lovely guy, and said, "Your daughter's watching her father take a bow in a Broadway show." And it kind of hit me, the satisfaction, you know, of how fortunate I am to do what I do, and that she was now of an age, I think maybe she was 10, that she could, and you know, she's piddled around in the theater, she's done some nice roles, and she's a wonderful actor herself and a good singer, and so she's kind of put her hands in a little bit, and to be able to share that with her, that moment with her, somebody had to kind of jogged me into thinking about it, but the satisfaction of that was kind of special. So now, and she'll see Witness for the Prosecution as well, because she'll be fascinated by this language in this piece, I think.
When you look at your career over 40 years or so, is there a secret to sustaining that long a career, or having a, you know, longevity of a career in the entertainment industry?
Balance. I don't define myself by the work. I love the work, but I have always loved a lot of other things, you know, and had other interests. And I think that is really, really important, to be curious about everything, to be well-read. And I know people have probably heard this before, and I don't mean to sound like I'm patting actors on the back, but the more experiences you have, the more you can bring to what you do. Because in the end, it's just pretending with technique. I just think having a life outside of the work and having that balance, whether it be a family or other interests, has been really important, because there have been really quiet times. And those times, you know, you question if you'll ever work again, or if you're doing the kind of work or the level of work that you wanted to be doing at this point in your life, and then something comes along, and it's just always surprising. So you have to look at the aggregate, and also you have to be a nice guy about it, you know? I mean, the amount of time you spend actually on a set of a film or at a theater rehearsal, or on stage performing for an audience, you know, 75-80% of the time is with the other actors, with the producers, rehearsing. And so you have to have a certain kind of honor and integrity about that aspect of it. I love the people. I love the people involved in what I do. They're creative. They do it for love. I think even more so the theater, because there's not a lot of money in theater, that people do it because they love it, not because they're going to get rich doing it. That's what I miss the most when I'm not working, is that collaborative kind of sense where we're all getting in a room and we all depend on each other. The person that's designing the costumes, the set designer to enable you to tell the story effectively, you know, the people that are providing the props. It's really, really a team effort. And, you know, to celebrate each other, you know, after opening night, because I've been in plenty of plays that I never thought we were going to get there. You know, and it doesn't matter if it's a $15 million Broadway play or if it's a little tiny piece in a 90-seat theater. It's all the same. People say, oh, if we only had my... And I say, no, I've done the bigger stuff. We're always like scared and going over our lines and hoping that piece of set will move when it's supposed to, whether you have $15 million to spend or whether you're doing it for $1,000. At some point, you just have to like go for it. And that kind of spirit is what I love about what I do, you know, because the challenge is, it's always challenging.
I want to remind you that Campbell is starring in the Judson Theater production of Witness for the Prosecution, which opens November 21st. More information on that can be found in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to the podcast. Follow us on social media at RDU on Stage. Become a patron of this program by visiting our Patreon page, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.